You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, it's Dog Eat Dog on Broadway, which isn't the name of a new production about canine cannibalism. The Tony nominations are out and Matt Wolfe is here to guide us through them.
Also ahead, we'll welcome a true audiophile into the studio for today's music review. Colleen Murphy will tell us why life is best spent listening to iconic vinyl from cover to cover.
That one you may know, there will be others. We'll also be finding out why this...
Il va vous falloir accepter.
Est-ce que tu crois que quand quelqu'un meurt, il peut revenir?
We'll soon be filling TV screens across Europe.
Sounds terrifying. Plus, we'll have a five-step guide for a great weekend in Tokyo. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review, here on Monocle 24. So lots to look forward to. In the meantime, Andrew Muller, what was your cultural highlight this week?
I've mostly been reading a book about bees, which we talked about on the programme last week.
So inspired you were. What's it like? It's upstairs in the office and it looks charming.
It is. It's really good. It's called A Sting in the Tail, which is an excruciating but probably inevitable title. That's Sting, T-A-L-E is what they've done there. You see they've done the cunning double meaning of... But anyway, but it is about bumblebees particularly and about how some English species have become extinct but may be reintroduced because they got moved to New Zealand
and
through various means.
And had you not been host of The Review last week, would you have been naturally drawn to this book?
Yes, I would have because I have bees in my garden which I'm trying to encourage further. But actually because I've now read the book, I can now tell some varieties of bees from other bees, and also it did tell me where would be a good place and how is a good way to find bumblebee nests, and I'm pleased to discover that I have at least two.
How lovely.
It is. It's a lovely book. Dave Goulson, A Sting in the Tail, which we have also covered elsewhere on Monocle 24 this week. So I hope people have been listening. It's a delightful book.
My cultural highlight this week was going to the Courthole Gallery at Somerset House in London to the Pablo Picasso breakthrough exhibition called Becoming Picasso, Paris 1901. An astonishing little exhibition. I mean little, it's two really small rooms. All containing work by Picasso when he was 19. We've done this on The Review before. And these two rooms of pictures, which he painted in Paris when he first arrived and he was being sponsored by Ambroise Vollard, are quite spectacular because the blue period hasn't quite arrived yet, and we don't quite see Picasso's true style coming through. But what we do see is Picasso is channeling everybody. So you look at a picture and you think, that's a Velasquez by Picasso. Or you see, that's a Manet by Picasso. That's a Cezanne by Picasso. It's absolutely amazing to think that this was all done by one man in 1 year. And all you need is two very, very perfect rooms. I would argue it's one of the most perfect little exhibitions I've been to for a very, very long time, because it makes its point absolutely beautifully and really simply. In addition to that, I can bring us live cultural news. I'm trying to the tickets have become available for this year's proms in London, and I quite like a prom, and so I have joined up to try and get tickets. When I logged on this morning at 9 a.m. sharp, I was in competition with 5,830 other people in the queue to get tickets. I am now number 4059. No, I'm not. I'm number 4057. And so during today's review, we shall bring you live cultural breaking news to see if I will ever get a ticket for anything at the Royal Albert Hall later on this year.
How does this work? Do we have to wait for the people ahead of you to die, or?
Well, given the average age of the prom.
Well, I'd say that's a possibility.
It's a possibility,
exactly.
Which is always a thing because tickets come up later during the year as well, perhaps for that reason.
I suspect so.
Anyway.
Don't whisper. What you should be doing is making lots of really sudden, loud noises in case any of them are listening.
Well, they're all hovered over their laptops at home. In the home counties of England.
But we should do that during the programme. We should blow up some paper bags and then pop them, perhaps.
How cruel, Andrew Muller. You're listening to The Review.
Just trying to help. As if it weren't tough enough already, it's getting even more vicious on Broadway. With the Tonys on their way, a pattern seems to be developing between those shows with fistfuls of nominations and those with not very much at all. Antoinette Perry, the co-founder of the American Theatre Wing, after whom the Tonys are named, has a lot to answer for.
So how much is Theatreland being divided into the spectacular success and the spectacular failure? Well, we're delighted to welcome back the IHT theatre critic and regular Monocle contributor Matt Wolfe into the studio. Hello, Matt. A very warm welcome back to the programme. You have seen no fewer than, what, 13 productions in New York. You're a trooper.
I'm an obsessive. Not all of them, Emma, I have to say, on Broadway. There's some very good things off Broadway, but of course, the thing about the Tonys is they are entirely Broadway fixated, so off Broadway doesn't get a look in. And this is the time of year when everything is about Broadway, Broadway, Broadway. What wins, what loses, what runs, what closes.
And the big nomination this year was for Kinky Boots.
Kinky Boots got 13 nominations to Matilda's 12, and the two seem to be neck and neck in almost every category. And in a way, it makes for interesting viewing when the ceremony finally happens on the 9th of June, because whereas in many years there's an obvious front runner, when the Book of Mormon was nominated a couple years ago, everyone knew it would sweep, and indeed it did. This year it could go either way. I suppose you could argue that the British can't lose either way, because Matilda is a British musical imported from Stratford and then London, and Kinky Boots, although American, is based on a British movie, but it's a real Americanization of it in feeling and tone. It's still set in Northampton in England, which is where the film was set in 2005, but it's all got very sort of full of inspirational uplift and songs with titles like Everybody Say Yeah, Raise You Up, Hold Me in Your Heart.
It may just be me, but there is almost nothing in this world I find more depressing than inspirational uplift.
Well, in order to depress you even further, let's have a listen to Everybody Say Yeah.
Price and Sons spent the last century making a range of shoes for men. We will begin this century making a range of shoes for a range of men.
Andrew's just had a heart attack later.
It sounds like the thing that a kind of entire field full of people sing just before someone starts ladling out the Kool-Aid.
Well, Sondheim it ain't, that's for sure. It sort of turns the Al Hirschfeld Theater on 45th Street into a clapathon, as you can tell. And the score is by Cyndi Lauper, of course, who is not known
Imagine
for...
Imagine my surprise.
Yeah, quite. Not known for her Broadway work, but of course is very successful in other fields. And if she wins on June 9th, she'll be the first ever woman to win for her composing lyricist skills on Broadway.
There's something that I always think when you have a very, very uplifting piece of theatre that suddenly grabs the attention of the world. I'm thinking of Mamma Mia as well in the cinema. I always wonder whether a recession will often prompt something like this, that there is a real need for a sort of instant hit of feel-good sugariness.
I think that's right. I mean, what this musical traffics in is absolute and total gratification, often at the expense of common sense. Well, one of the big differences...
Well, that's never stopped anybody before.
Yeah. I mean, the movie, as I remember it from 7-8 years ago, whenever it was, at least held together as a coherent narrative. This actually makes no sense at all, because it's all about getting the narrative to the point of this spurious uplift so that the audience goes out grinning.
What's the plot?
The plot is basically a guy in Northampton whose father has died. He runs a shoe factory. The son inherits the shoe factory, although it's probably not what he would have wanted to do, left to his own devices. And the shoe factory has fallen on hard times, but he discovers that there's a market in peddling kinky boots, i.e. shoes for a range of men, cross-dressers, transvestites, and so on. And he strikes up a friendship with Lola, who's a local transvestite, played, I must say, wonderfully by Billy Porter. And Billy Porter will be the main competition for Matilda's Bertie Carvel when it comes to Best Actor in a Musical. So we'll see.
Now, this started off in Chicago, didn't it? How much does that help its journey to Broadway?
Well, what Chicago does is just give it an out-of-town berth. And that's what, in effect, Matilda had when it began in Stratford and then went to London. It's very rare now nowadays for shows to open cold on Broadway. There's just too much money at stake. And one of the things about, you know, the much reviled Spider-Man musical is that it was so complicated physically they couldn't take it anywhere beforehand. So all of its birthing pangs were in New York. This means they could iron out the kinks, you'll forgive the pun, in Chicago.
Did you enjoy either Kinky Boots or Matilda?
Well, I've seen Matilda many times beginning in Stratford, so I sort of feel like it's a bit of an old friend. There's an irony, which is that Matilda's a show about a five-year-old girl, so you would think that it's essentially going to dumb down the material. But weirdly, even though there are no five-year-old girls in sight in Kinky Boots, Kinky Boots is the less sophisticated, less mature piece, and Matilda's much, much richer.
We began this interview by saying that life is getting very, very vicious on Broadway. Tell us a little bit more about who's winning and who is dying a death.
Tony nomination day, for instance, one of the nominations for Best Play, an Irishman, Colm Tobin, who's based in New York where he's a university professor, he was nominated for his first ever play, The Testament of Mary, which is a solo play, I should say now was a solo play, about the mother of Jesus, and it was acted on Broadway, that part, by Fiona Shaw. And everyone was expecting a nomination for her, not for the play. The play was nominated, she wasn't, and within hours of his Best Play nomination, the show posted a closing notice, and Fiona Shaw is now out of work.
Why?
Because they needed to nominate the talent that the audience could see. It needed to be Fiona Shaw's award-winning performance in. In a funny way, the fact that the play was nominated in audience terms was less appealing. There was a similar non-nomination for a rather bigger name than Fiona Shaw, I must say, and that's the wonderful Bette Midler, who's back on Broadway for the first time in about 30 years in a solo play which got no nominations at all called I'll Eat You Last. And I have to say, Bette Midler and co. are getting the last laugh on Broadway. A, the show is a huge hit. B, it's very, very good. C, the audience that's going to see it doesn't give a hoot about the nominations and could watch her in this show till kingdom come.
Well, this is always a question that strikes me about award ceremonies of any sort, whether they actually make any real difference to anything outside the people in the room who are either getting one or giving one.
Well, they make a difference, of course, as far as perpetuating the franchise. I mean, you know, the fact that Matilda won seven Oliviers in London and then went to Broadway, that was great grist for the mill in New York. If it wins a lot of Tonys and it then gets cloned around the world, it's helpful. But yeah, you could say that it's the industry talking to the industry. But it's always nicer to win an award than not to win.
I mean, have awards become of this sort? Do you think they've become less relevant as it's now easier for word of mouth to be diffused among more and more people, independent of what the industry decides?
I think for musicals, awards are icing on the cake. The thing is, musicals will have their own narrative. The hottest musical, in a way, of all the new musicals is a show called Motown, which is a jukebox musical about, guess what, Motown. And that didn't figure very heavily at all, but it doesn't matter. It's produced by Berry Gordy. They're laughing all the way to the bank. With plays have a tougher time of it in general, particularly in a climate where tickets cost $150 or more ahead. So you really do want some sort of award impetus to drive you, unless you're Bette Midler.
Or indeed Tom Hanks, because we've talked about this also in the review before, which is the Tom Hanks in Lucky Guy, the Pulitzer Prize-winning, the tale of the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, yeah. Mike McCleary. I remember you saying when you were last here that the play itself isn't so great, that it's okay. Nonetheless, it is a vehicle for Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
So you have this sort of flip side that Fiona Shaw is the great, doesn't get the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
The play itself does, it closes.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hanks, but conversely with Lucky Guy, the play is terrible, but Tom Hanks gets the nomination.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Lucky Guy's terrible. I think that's overselling it. I think that it's a patchwork quilt of a play by a woman who obviously wasn't alive to finesse it, Nora Ephron, who sadly died before its premiere. It's a terrific production by George C. Wolfe, no relation to me, and Tom Hanks does a terrific job driving it. But it's an ensemble piece. It isn't a one-man show, and it's had six nominations, and I think it's going to come up trumps in quite a few categories. Tom Hanks has some stiff competition, not least from Broadway regular Nathan Lane, who's giving a terrific performance in a play called The Nance. But I think this is going to be Tom Hanks's year, partly because they'll want to thank him for coming to Broadway. I have a friend who saw it last weekend, paid $700 for two tickets. And since
what?
It's $350 apiece. And as it's a limited run, it's finishing July 3rd, the demand will just intensify as the end of the run gets nearer. And, you know, there are not a lot of people with that sort of star power.
What, I mean, just briefly diverting from the content of the plays, what checks and balances are there to ensure that tickets don't go completely sky high.
Oh, there are no checks and balances at all. I mean, you know, when the Book of Mormon first opened and it was the hottest ticket in the world, people were handing over, you know, several thousand. It's all about what the market can bear. And the problem is, of course, there will always be those people who will pay $350 a ticket to see Tom Hanks in a play. The question is, will they see another play in the remaining 11 months? If not, in a way, Broadway loses because you get one ticket buyer per year.
Although, as we are learning, a sort of major star and indeed a Tony nomination is no guarantee of success, as Alec Baldwin has been discovering.
I think the difference is that Tom Hanks is sort of Mr. Nice Guy. He was Mr. Nice Guy in Hollywood. Everyone loves him. And he's proven to be Mr. Nice Guy on Broadway. He's going to every function. He's nice at the stage door. He does all the requisite TV appearances. Alec Baldwin has come across for a long time as a grump. I mean, he's getting in trouble with paparazzi. He's bad-mouthing the press. And lo and behold, he didn't get a Tony nomination here for his recent production of Orphan, still running, but it's closing on the 19th. His colleague, Tom Sturridge, whose English did get nominated, what does Alec do? He turns around and writes a piece on the Huffington Post, blasting the current theater critic of the New York Times, who happened not to like his performance. That's what theater critics do. They assess your performance.
But does that really, I mean, I'm not against niceness. I'm all in favor of niceness by and large, but does that really sell you tickets at $350 a head?
I don't think that sells the tickets on niceness alone doesn't do it, but it's part of a bigger package. I think Alec is Mr. Grinch, and he was saying about the current theater critic, well, I wish we'd had the previous theater critic back. Well, the reason he liked the previous theater critic is he got good reviews from him. You know.
So what you saw 13 in total when you were over in New York. Tell us what you saw.
Well, I love the Bette Midler play, which I've mentioned. I thought that was very good. Nathan Lane and the Nance, a terrific, very ambitious play about sort of self-loathing amongst the gay community in New York in the 1930s, a time when if you were gay, you had to be gay very surreptitiously and covertly and were under threat of arrest virtually constantly. Very different role for Nathan Lane because he takes his sort of high-style theatrics and kind of inverts them. A very, very fine performance, beautifully done by Lincoln Center Theatre. A lovely play by Richard Greenberg, a writer who's well-known in London, has a play coming up here called The American Plan, called The Assembled Parties, set across 1980 and 2000 in Manhattan, full of grief and pain. I mean, there are some interesting things on Broadway, but I just think the spectrum is going to narrow exponentially as the stakes get ever higher.
Matt Wolfe, thank you as ever for coming into the studio to join us on The Review.
A pleasure.
The time is 90 minutes past the hour. Next up is Nelly Gacheva's guide to the weekend's must-see highlights from around the world.
Next week, here on Monaco 24, it'll be all about the Eurovision Song Contest. From interviews with contestants...
We're here representing Finland in Eurovision Song Contest, and it's been a really crazy schedule. I've been doing a lot of promotion and interviews, and then I've been recording my album, so I haven't had any free time at all.
To in-depth analysis with Eurovision experts, and much more from our live coverage of the event in host city Malmö. Eurovision, all next week on Monaco 24.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. And if you're wondering what to do this weekend, you need look or indeed listen no further. Our associate editor, Nelly Gacheva, is here to bring us some cultural highlights from around the world.
In Buenos Aires this weekend, catch the closing days of the Libros Como Puentes, the country's three-week book festival. It has been held annually since 1975, and it is the Spanish-speaking world's largest book fair. This year's edition has also named Amsterdam as a special foreign city guest. Dutch writers Maarten Asscher and Gerbrand Becker will be present to discuss their works. The book fair is on until the 13th of May. British documentary Village at the End of the World by Sarah Gavron is finally out on DVD. The film tells the tale of the village of Nyakornat in the far northwest of Greenland. Reached only by ship or helicopter, the village has a population of 59. Gavron's picture gives an informative account of one of the most remote locations on Earth. The 29th edition of Mexico City's Art Festival kicked off this Thursday with performances, art exhibits and food tasting held in several venues throughout the city. Originally started as an initiative to revitalize the historic heart of Mexico City, today the festival has grown to become an international event accommodating 47 acts from around the world. On Saturday, check out Miguel Moreira's modern ballet, The Old King, performed by Belgian dance theatre collective Le Ballet C de la Baie. The festival runs until the 19th of May at various locations across the city. For more information, go to festival.org.mx. This weekend in London is your last chance to see the works of the winners of the Sony World Photography Awards at Somerset House. The 700 photos on show range in subject from current affairs to fashion, travel and wildlife. The exhibition also honors American photographer William Egglestone for his outstanding contribution to the field over the past four decades. The Sony World Photography Award show is at Somerset House until Sunday. This weekend, we'll be listening to Atlantis indie rockers Deer Hunter and their new album, Monomania. From it, this is the track, The Missing. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva. That was The Missing by Deer Hunter, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. It is easier to be a music fan than it has ever been. Limitless quantities of the stuff are readily available. If you're not overburdened by scruple, you don't have to pay for any of it, and you can fit what would once have been the contents of an entire shelf-lined extension in your pocket. None of which is bad, but it does mean that we have essentially traded pleasure for convenience.
By which we mean that the MP3 player sound is inferior to vinyl, digital recording isn't as good as tape, and dwindling attention spans have all but destroyed the album as an art form. This week's musical guest, however, is doing her part to reverse this. A brave lady, DJ Cosmo, known to her friends as Colleen Murphy, is an uncompromising and innovative DJ attempting to preserve the lost values, whether at her classic album Sunday's listening events or travelling the world playing her distinctive mix of deep electronic and psychedelic music. She joins us now in the studio. A very warm welcome, DJ.
Hello.
Do we call you DJ Cosmo or do we call you Colleen?
Colleen.
Thank you very much, Colleen. As we've just mentioned, I get the impression that you're fighting against a huge tide of bad attention spans.
Not at
and MP3s.
All. I mean, actually, it's been quite the opposite. I mean, what I kind of started Classic Album Sundays because, as you said, I do feel that people have might not be paying attention to music as closely as they could be. It's kind of an oral backdrop. It's like oral wallpaper. But when I started these Classic Album Sundays 2.5 years ago, I had no idea about the response it would get. So quite the opposite. I feel buoyed by so many people who just feel the same way and who are loving the fact that we're doing this.
Tell us how they work.
Okay, basically, Classic Album Sundays as a monthly listening session. For the first 2 hours, I play music that is somehow related to the featured album. So it could be a contemporary artist to the release or a contemporary album that was released at the time of the album's release. Or it could be an artist that influenced the featured album, as well as some of the artist's earlier works. So you kind of get a musical context. And at this time, phones aren't turned off and the music is more of a background listening level and people are eating and drinking and being merry. Then when we enter the third hour, it's phones are off, the lights go down, and me or whoever is presenting gives a whole story about the album and maybe any kind of personal revelations they may have about the album. And then it's straight into the album, beginning to end, on vinyl, on an amazing audiophile hi-fi. So people really immerse themselves into it, and they don't speak, and they just turn their phones off, close their eyes, and just listen for 45 minutes.
Yeah. It is an illustration in itself of how the consumption of music has changed, though, isn't it? Because what you say is true. The classic albums especially have become records that you hear so much of them whether you want to or not. They're just always in the background of commercials in shops. You actually now have to make an effort to sit down and think, I'm actually going to listen to Elvis Presley.
To the entire thing. The entire thing. Absolutely.
Does it seem to require a huge effort by the audience? Do you get that first two or three tracks of people sort of fidgeting and looking
anxious
and nervous? And
you're absolutely right, actually. The first couple songs, if they're an initiate, a novice, they don't really know what to do with their eyes, you know? It's like they're kind of like looking around and they're a little bit nervous. And you do get a few people who are like the doubters who want to come in, usually journalists. They want to like doubt it. They want to like put it down. But I have always had the same response. You know, I didn't realize I was going to enjoy that so much. And what happens is people usually come for an album they know, and then they start coming along to more events. Some come every single time they come along, no matter what the album is.
I find when I'm just, your subject has made me try to reassess slightly my listening habits, which are now awful, and I'm very upset. You know.
We all do. Don't believe me. I'm not some kind of audio goddess.
It is that terrible thing that I use. Well, you're doing your best.
I'm trying.
I used to buy albums, and I used to bring them home, and of course there's that physical reminder in the room that you've got to go and listen to this. Now I will download something, and I will forget, and about 6 months later I'll think, what have I downloaded? I can't remember. Do you think that we're setting ourselves up for a really big problem in about 10, 15 years' time when the albums that are out now won't have been listened to in their entirety at all by lots of people?
I have found this exact thing to be true with myself as well. Even as a DJ, people would send me free tracks, they download them, then they went on to play them out for a little bit, and then they went into a hard drive into my desk. And I never go looking for them again. I have about 10,000 albums sitting there. And when I want to hear something, that's what I'm flipping through. I think the thing with vinyl that's quite interesting is it's very inconvenient. It's cumbersome. But because it's inconvenient, it makes you engage. So, for instance, if you put a CD on in your room, you can walk out and the CD will just turn off. It'll just stop. You don't have to worry about a stylus getting blunted as it, you know, goes on the runout groove, nearly hitting the inner label. With vinyl, you have to actually engage with it in real time.
You have to pay attention not just to the thing as a work of art, but also as an artifact.
Absolutely. So you have to go over, you have to put the needle down, you have to flip it and all that. And also, because it is so inconvenient, it's a lot harder to kind of flip through tracks. So usually, there's a lot of albums that only have one or two good songs, and you go and you play those one or two good songs.
Most albums don't have that many.
Yeah, you're right. I totally agree. But there are so many albums, and it's funny because we have these album suggestion boards, and I'm reminded of how many great albums are out there at every single session. And there's so many great ones, and they, you know, with the vinyl format, it almost does make you listen from beginning to end.
I'm just looking at some of at your recent events, and you've got New Order, Power Corruption and Lies, Talking Heads, Remain in Light, Massive Attack, Blue Lines, which we'll hear a little bit from in a minute, and David Bowie's Hunky Dory. They all stop at a certain time. They all stop at a certain period in time. We don't have very recent classic albums, which I'm sure you can't.
I have done a few. It's just what you've probably seen the last few months. There was one. I mean, the only one from the last decade, which was requested multiple times before her death. I will say this is Amy Winehouse.
Back to Black.
Back to Black. Yeah, and that. We did do, unfortunately, it was the month after she died. We did have her a co-writer and publisher, so we had some amazing demo material, which did bring a tear or two, or quite a few tears to many people's eyes. But it is, I see what you're saying on the other side, because it is kind of harder to understand what album is going to have classic status until some time has passed. So, yes. There haven't been a lot in the last 10 years. Although it's interesting to keep your eyes on certain albums. And there's certain albums that I like beginning to end quite a lot that are more recent. You know, albums that I absolutely love listening to beginning to end. But I think it does take maybe a bit of time for it to achieve that classic status.
Do you not think as well possibly that the diminishment of a classic pantheon of records, it's diminishing returns. There's kind of a mathematical inevitability to it. If you talk about a record like Power, Corruption, and Lies, which came out, what, 25, nearly 30 years ago?
30 years ago this year.
But then you think, okay, so that was 1983, mm-hmm. 30 years ago. What was music 30 years before that?
Yeah.
Bill Haley hadn't had a hit with Rock Around the Clock.
It's a lot of jazz.
But the point is that there's only so much you can do with three chords and a minor before the chorus. and I do think that that's where it has started to run out of steam.
Interesting. I never really thought about it too much in that way as far as what the actual material, I mean, as far as composing music, it sounds like is what
I mean, the point
about.
Being that if you'd gone to 1953 with Power, Corruption, and Lies and said music will sound like this in 30 years, people just would have gone, oh my God, I've never heard anything like that ever. But it's very hard to imagine that kind of trajectory is still as steep.
But we always, you know, I think technology we are always surprised. And I can't say absolutely that will be the case. Like, for instance, you know, you're thinking even with technology, maybe technology is going to be, well, it has been. I mean, it's been such a massive influence in music making. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, let's try and answer it with your first track, because I think we can introduce an artist who possibly defies Andrew's law of diminishing returns. I'm talking about David Bowie.
Oh, yeah.
Someone who has been continuously inventive for decades and decades. We're going to play a little bit of Heroes in just a minute. Tell us a little bit about the event that you hosted around it last weekend.
Sure. I did an event at the New Museum in New York City with Red Bull Music Academy, where I had three of David Bowie's producers. Ken Scott, who produced loads of his albums, Hunky Dory, Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, and Pinups. He co-presented Ziggy with me. I had Tony Visconti, who's produced 12 Bowie studio albums, including the latest, The Next Day. We did Heroes. And then Nile Rodgers with Let's Dance. And it was really amazing. We had, you know, session up three separate events, but it was a whole day with a half-hour switch in between. It was run like clockwork, or as Tony told me, you ran it like a well-programmed LP.
Was there a different kind of audience coming to the Bowie and in particular the Nile Rodgers event, given the fact that both are utterly enjoying a second period in the sun at the moment?
Well, it was interesting. There were some different, I mean, there were some kids that bought tickets for all three. And I'm saying, you know, kids in their 20s. That's a kid to me now. But there were some distinct different flavors as well. I would say the Heroes one had more of a freaky atmosphere, which was quite fun.
Let's have a listen to Heroes.
Bring
David Bowie with Heroes, obviously the first selection of this week's musical guest, Colleen Murphy from Classic Album Sundays. Bowie has, of course, been in the news a lot recently with his startling and startlingly good comeback, though he is an interesting case, and I guess it's one of the interesting things about revisiting these older records is that it prompts these discussions, as it did round my way a few weeks ago. Is there another artist of whom you can say that there is as big a gulf between the best of their best and the worst of their worst?
Neil Young.
Somebody did suggest Neil Young. Stevie Wonder.
John Lennon.
Somebody put John Lennon, who of course was at once in the Beatles and yet recorded the worst song ever recorded, which is of course Imagine. Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney, you could make a similar argument for as well.
Yeah.
It is amazing that David Bowie could both do that and then do most of what he did in the 80s with his suit jacket sleeves rolled up and that stupid guitar with no top on it and people
sure
playing the bass with their
thumbs. I'm not sure how many artists there are now who can come back as well as Bowie did. I don't think I can think of anybody else. How about you, Colleen?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it would be interesting if someone like Stevie did. I think that'd be incredible. But I agree. Well, Neil Young. Neil Young has many times kind of bounced back.
Let's move on to your second choice, which is a song which I could listen to forever, Massive Attack, Unfinished Sympathy.
Yes.
Tell us why you've brought that in for us.
Well, one thing, I mean, I was living in New York City at the time it came out, and it was kind of, I mean, we're talking about good listening habits. I'm going to tell you, I listened to this my CD Walkman walking around New York City over and over again.
I had one of those, and I think I used it about twice ever before I actually threw it at a tree. It was hopeless.
Mine broke after about 10 minutes.
Well, mine broke after I threw it at a tree after about 10 minutes.
And I just think it's just a wonderful album from beginning to end. And it's been requested a lot of times at Classic Album Sundays. And it's our June Classic Album of the Month. And it does kind of make me think of summer as well, in the sense that it's some really great kind of beautiful kind of club songs on there. End of the night kind of anthems, which I have played in many festival sets.
How many albums do you think have that quality that you just said that Blue Lines has, which is it is a good complete album?
There's surprisingly a lot more than I thought before I started Classic Album Sundays. I mean, as I said before, I do get people's input where we put up a poster at the sessions and ask people to suggest them. And it is surprising. I mean, there's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of great records. Well, we should be going for a while.
Let's have a listen to Unfinished Sympathy. Massive Attack, Unfinished Sympathy there from the album Blue Lines. It is the choice of DJ Cosmo, otherwise known as Colleen Murphy, the lady behind Classic Album Sundays, and also behind something called Lucky Cloud Loft.
Yes, me and a few other people as well. Yeah, it's a group team effort, this one.
What is it?
Lucky Cloud is a party we started 10 years ago based upon the template of David Mancuso's loft parties, which he started in 1970, which has kind of been the part that was the party that really started the whole club movement, although it's not a club, you know, with the Paradise Garage following and the gallery in downtown New York City in the 70s. And we started a party. David's been a mentor of mine. I was playing at the loft with him from the 90s. And this is where I got my love of hi-fi as well, because it's a hi-fi married with a early prototype of a club PA. So we have clipshorns all around a room and using Quetsu moving coil cartridges with dance music, which is quite interesting. And we have been doing these parties now for 10 years. And our 10th anniversary is this coming June, June 23rd. We do the parties four times a year. And they're kind of just very different than many other parties out there. It's a Sunday afternoon. It goes from 5 to midnight.
Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, Colleen. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. We're going to play a little bit from the Lucky Cloud Loft Party 10th anniversary. This is CJ and Company. We got our own thing.
And we definitely do.
We got it.
CJ and Company with We Got Our Own Thing, the final selection by this week's music guest, Colleen Murphy from Classic Album Sundays. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And Monocle 24 said goodbye to an integral member of its team yesterday. Researcher Adrian Craddock is returning home to Australia and will be sorely missed. But he's stopping off in Asia along the way, and he thought he'd guide us through a great weekend in Tokyo. Adrian, take it away.
I'm flying to Australia via Tokyo next week, so many people have passed me tips on how to best experience the city. I'm looking forward to starting at the Ghibli Museum, a sprawling mecca of Japanese animation. The institution mainly exhibits the works of Studio Ghibli, which is responsible for anime classics like My Neighbor Totoro and Spirited Away. It's full of original prints and winding rooms splattered with kooky frescoes. The current exhibition is about Scottish folklorist Andrew Lang, whose books gained popularity at a time when Japan's modernisation process was hitting full stride. I've been warned though, reservations are essential. I'll also be around for the first anniversary of the completion of the Sky Tree Tower. 1 year on, the 634-metre-tall tower has become one of the city's most visited tourist attractions. On a clear day, you're supposed to see Mount Fuji, 100 kilometres away. On a cloudy day, I've heard you may as well be in a room with the windows painted white. Either way, the immense earthquake-proof design has become a favourite of the city's most discerning architects. For a peek into old Tokyo, there's also Manda Katsuri, a Shinto festival that goes until Wednesday. The event only happens every odd-numbered year, and in 2011 it was cancelled because of the Tohoku earthquake. If you can only see one part of it, I'd advise tomorrow's parade. Around 100 locals will take to the streets carrying portable shrines. It's supposed to be a real sight to behold. After all that culture and tradition, I'd expect to have built up a bit of a thirst. Cue the Kahakihabara Spring Beer Festival, a four-day event that celebrates Japan's thriving microbrewery scene. Increasingly popular brews like Kahido, Sankta Gallen, and Aquala will all be there. The event starts on Thursday, and you can get samples for just 300 yen. Also expect seafood and plenty of J-pop. For Monocle, I'm Adrian Craddock.
Of course, it wouldn't be Monocle 24 without a little bit of J-pop. And a huge thank you to Adrian from all of us here at Monocle. You'll be sorely missed, Adrian. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, where after the break, it's time to soak up some international television.
Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wink Content and is edited by Tyler Boulay and Andrew Tuck. We have bureau in New York, Toronto, Tokyo, Hong Kong and Zurich, and a growing network of dedicated correspondents. Monocle 24's headquarters are at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, London. If you'd like to get in touch about sponsorship opportunities, please send an email to vc@monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller and Emma Nelson. It's time now to look at what the contents of Europeans' television screens will look like over the coming months. Apparently, they will be full of zombies, Russian spies and Gillian Anderson, not at the same time, although I, for one, would totally watch that.
Well, to talk us through her top picks, we're delighted to welcome back Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast. A very warm welcome to the programme, Lisa. What an amazing array of programmes that you've brought in to talk to us. Every single one seems to be very good this time. We've got some good ones.
I always bring good ones, don't I?
No, but in an uncontroversial way.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think these are absolute
top quality dramas. And I think the, you know, if we're talking quality, Rebound, as it's called in the UK, or Les Revenants in France, which is a huge hit there. It's actually based on, it's an adaptation of the 2004 film of the same name. It's sold to 19 countries, so including Sweden, the Netherlands, Israel, Turkey, New Zealand, Hong Kong and Hungary. So I expect it to be, you know, pretty big everywhere as well. But it's really stunning. I mean, it looks beautiful. It's shot by Fabrice Gobert, and it's very atmospheric, the photography, and he's influenced by the American photographer Gregory Crudson, and there's, you know, his sort of quite disturbing scenes and very sort of surreal small town America. It's got a bit of a Twin Peaks feel. I always hesitate to make that comparison because, you know, what can possibly compare to Twin Peaks, but it has got that sort of the surreal qualities, amazing atmosphere, very chilling, beautiful people, and you know, fantastic script. So
it has a very simple premise, doesn't it? There's a small village in France. There is a bus crash with a load of teenagers on it.
Yep.
And a mother walks into the kitchen to find the child who she understands to have been killed.
Yeah, 4 years ago.
4 years ago, in the kitchen, mouthful, going, really, you know, just helping herself to something in the fridge, going, something really strange has happened to me.
Yes.
And we basically have more and more of the dead, les revenants, people coming back, just walking back into people's lives. But unlike many zombie things, these... Well, rather in a typically French thing. These zombies are incredibly handsome, aren't they?
Exactly.
Very stylish.
Yeah, so lots of beautiful young French people all over this, which does make it very appealing. But it's real quality. I think fantastic performance from the girl who plays the character Camille. It's really haunting, I think. And the soundtrack is also amazing. I think that adds a real quality to it. And that's the Scottish band Mogwai. And they wrote the soundtrack before the film. And, you know, they were instructed, we want something really sort of haunting. So it's quite an unusual way around to do it.
Well, let's have a little listen to this.
Moi, je me fais peur. D'après nos fichiers, vous êtes mort.
Vous connaissez Adèle Werther ?
Et tout le monde connaît son histoire. Son fiancé est mort le jour de son mariage.
T'es tellement beau.
C'est qui ?
C'est ton papa.
Vous saviez qu'il s'était suicidé ?
It was a clip from Rebound, the first of today's selections by our guest television reviewer, Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast. It's not an original premise, the idea of the dead returning. I've always thought it'd be kind of awkward, wouldn't it?
Well, I think what's interesting is, you know, we've seen zombies a lot in the past, but they've always been a bit unpleasant, haven't they? And it's more about, you know, we feel something for these people.
They've made,
you know,
more of an effort with their appearance this time, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but, well, they're, you know, it's trying to be, you know, this is someone's daughter and son and other half, and I think, you know, you're connecting with those characters. They're not these sort of just scary monsters, you know, so it's a much more of an emotional attachment, I think, to zombies than we've had.
It does get quite catastrophic, though, doesn't it? I mean, every zombie series does have to have a rather, you know, dastardly deadly element to it. How successful do you think this is in Rebound? The fact that it starts off on a very, very low scale, but obviously they live near this big dam, don't they? So something terrible has to happen.
Yes, yeah. And there's it's just lots of moments where, you know, flickering lights and the dam is slowly draining and these sort of strange happenings going on in the town. And it's a slow boiler. I mean, it is kind of in the tradition of The Killing, really. And you know, there's always the inevitable comparisons, you know, at the moment with these sort of crime dramas. But it is in that vein of it's slow and it's haunting and you're not quite sure really what's going on and what's happening. But it's much more surreal than I think things we've seen before. Much more of the sort of the fantasy style of crime drama is coming back. And I don't think we've seen that for a while.
It has a bit of originality to it. Let's move on to another crime drama. Well, a crime drama, the last one was obviously a zombie drama. The Fall, Gillian Anderson, a new vehicle for Gillian Anderson.
Yeah, so this is a co-production with the BBC, with Ireland's RTE, German broadcaster ZDF and Belgium's VMMA. It's filmed in Northern Ireland and it's directed by Belgian director Jacob Verbrugge and stars the X-Files' Gillian Anderson. So a real international flavour to this one. And I mean, you know, crime drama has always been one of the best-selling genre globally.
There has been something of a renaissance in crime drama recently, though. I mean, between the critically acclaimed Wire, those sort of endless amounts of barely distinguishable Scandinavian ones, is this in that tradition, or have they gone a bit more CSI?
I think it sort of subverts that tradition, actually, because from the moment he takes his balaclava off at the start of this five-part drama, we know who the killer is. I mean, I'll describe the start, and don't worry, we don't need a massive spoiler alert thing, if you've got that technique here. We see this young actor, Jamie Dornan, is this handsome young man, and he's stalking a woman in Belfast city centre. Looks like, you know, he could quite easily get her. The mask comes off, he has a son, he has a daughter too, he's married as well, apparently in a loving relationship. And then in another twist, he works as a grief counsellor, consoling parents whose children have died. So we're only a fifth of the way through, and all of this revealed. It's actually constructed as a series of revelations, and each one is more compelling than the last. And the writer Alan Cubitt, he's behind things like Prime Suspect, you know, he wanted this sort of game of hot and cold where, you know, we, the audience, know who the killer is, and the police, led by Gillian Anderson and detective, you know, they're floundering. And I think he wanted to take it deeper. He said that, you know, there's two things lacking in crime drama, and that's sort of going into the reasons why somebody becomes a psychopath. And secondly, identification with the victim and the victim's family. You know, we tend to get this sort of slow, plodding police investigation. We don't really get any insight into those things, you know, the motivation particularly. So we're seeing it much more from that perspective, from the victim's family and from the psychopaths as well.
Let's have a little listen to it.
Welcome to Belfast. The killer is out there somewhere, and we have nothing at all.
This was not his first murder. Killed in their own homes by strangulation. Look, they could be sisters. We want to work closely with you to advance the investigation, not to find fault.
That was The Fall. Gillian Anderson with a cut glass English accent as well.
Yes, and it was apparently really difficult to persuade her to do a British drama. I think it's 10 years since she's taken a lead role in TV. And I think she was concerned it was going to be aping the glossy American crime dramas. And she said, you know, I'll only be interested in this if it's really different and it's gritty. And it's actually, that's what it is. I mean, the Belgian director has done an amazing job of making it feel very documentary feel, really. And lots of well-observed details. And you know how we usually get the sort of, you know, even in The Killing, Sarah Lund will be clomping around in her high heels and you're thinking, they're going to hear you. You know, this is Gillian Anderson in a, you know, she's got no makeup. She's got a big lumpy boiler suit. You know, it's real. She's kind of lying haggard and exhausted.
She still looks super glamorous.
She does. I mean, yeah, she's still amazing,
you know,
isn't she?
She's got some good moisturiser on, even though she's got the boiler suit. Let's move on to the Americans. Perhaps a sort of play on Homeland, maybe, and also a couple of years ago, there were those glamorous young Russians who were terrible spies.
Yeah.
These are slightly better.
I'm quite excited by this one because I think there's a car chase in this, isn't there?
There's lots of action in this, yes.
Excellent.
I mean, I think if you like Homeland, you're going to like this. It's just aired on the FX network in the US to widespread critical acclaim, and it's coming soon to the UK, Australia, Canada and Israel and a host of other territories. It's set in 1981, and it's just around the election of President Reagan, and it stars Matthew Rhys, so you've got another British actor. The Americans are really, you know, big fans here. And Golden Globe winner Kerry Russell. So they play KGB spies. It's in an arranged marriage, actually, but you know, they've got this perfect sort of American family life and they're lovely kids, and to all intents and purposes, they're loyal American citizens, you know, but deep down, you know, well, they've actually got a Russian defector in the boot of their car in the garage.
Yes. Let's have a quick listen.
Stop.
Counterintelligence is the place you want to be right now. We're up against the most sophisticated enemy in the world.
You're my wife.
Is that right?
Super secret spies living next door. They look like us. They speak better English than we do. They're not allowed to say a single word in Russian once they get here. And you make any noise, I will kill you.
Hi. President Reagan is outraged that the KGB thinks it can kidnap someone with impunity on American soil.
Our war is not so cold anymore, Elizabeth.
It's probably a coincidence.
Or they're onto us.
And this is what? We take those risks every day, Philip. That's what we do.
It's a clip from The Americans, the third selection of this week's guest television reviewer, Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast. You mentioned the obvious comparison there with Homeland, and speaking only for myself, though I love the Israeli series Prisoners of War, on which Homeland was based. Homeland itself, I found, silly is the only word I could really...
But compellingly so. I mean, how did the Americans jump over the silly aspect?
I found in Homeland the silliness overweighed the compellingness.
I agree. I think with the first series of Homeland, it was okay. When it got to the second series, it became a bit 24-esque, didn't it? And then I spoke to the boss of that network recently, and he said they really listened to viewers, actually, for the third series, and they're going to take that into account. This, I suppose, it's a bit more dramatic, and it's a heightened scenario, yes, I'll give you that. But the relationship between the couple is brilliant. Makes it really believable and really engaging. They're this couple who've been thrown together, and then he's starting to get more, the American values sort of creeping in, and then she's really sort of tough, and it's so brilliantly performed by the two of them, and that relationship is really central, and it makes you forgive this heightened scenarios that you're talking about.
Lisa Campbell from Broadcast, thank you very much indeed as ever for joining us. That brings us to the end of the review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer Katie Bilbao, our researcher Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and to our studio manager Chris Grimes.
We're handing back over to Louise with the weekend edition next, and don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly on Sunday at midday London time with Steve Bloomfield and Hugo MacDonald.
The review is back next weekend, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.